Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
Precedingly on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Can this German scientist justify his astonishing claim that these relics are an electric battery? Invented long before the birth of Christ.
The remarkable thing is that these objects are 2,200 years old. That means 2,000 years before electricity was invented in Europe, in Italy.
The Antikythera computer and the Baghdad battery, if indeed it is a battery, represent two of the great ifs of history because they're 2,000 years ahead of their time. If the societies that produce them had continued to develop their technologies, by now, it would be 4,000 AD. By this time, we would not merely have sent a few men to the moon. We would have colonized all the stars visible to the naked eye.
You're listening to episode 308 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where we look at mysteries from the twin perspectives of faith and reason. In this episode, we're talking about the mystery of the Baghdad Battery. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today is Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
In the 1930s, a strange object came to public attention. It was a small clay pot discovered near Baghdad, Iraq. One of the first scholars to examine it became convinced that it was an electric battery, despite the fact that it's around 2,000 years old, and it subsequently became known as the Baghdad Battery. Archaeologists have taken the idea that it's a battery seriously, but if that's the case, what would it mean? Would it mean that ancient Babylonians had electricity and electrical devices? Would it be a sign of advanced ancient technology? Would it indicate contact with an extraterrestrial civilization? What is the ultimate truth about the Baghdad Battery? Well, that's what we'll be talking about on this episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, when did you first become aware of the Baghdad Battery?
It was when I was a kid back in the 1970s. In 1978, the Swiss author Erich von Däniken published a book called Chariots of the Gods. And in 1970, they released a documentary movie of the same title. The basic premise of Chariots of the Gods is that ancient aliens visited Earth long ago, and so the book and the movie helped kick off the current ancient astronauts craze. Some of the evidence von Däniken cited in the book are what are now known as UPARTs. UPART stands for out-of-place artifacts. So UPARTs are artifacts that seem out of place, like being more technologically advanced than you would expect given where they were found. We'll talk more about UPARTs in future episodes of Mysterious World, but one of the UPARTs that von Däniken cited in both the book and the movie was the Baghdad Battery. They don't make a huge deal out of it in either, but here's the segment on the Baghdad Battery from the movie.
Once again in Iraq, the museum in Baghdad, we find these small clay cups dating to the time of Christ. They may be even older. A small copper tube was introduced into the narrow neck. A rod, made of an alloy of different metals, was inserted in the tube. When filled with hydrochloric acid, the device produces an electric current.
This was no doubt a primitive electric cell. Yet Count Volta invented the electric cell 1,500 years later.
In the book, von Däniken goes a bit further and cites the Baghdad Battery as evidence of contact with ancient aliens. Since his time, numerous other people have made similar claims about it, with it either being seen as evidence of ancient contact with extraterrestrials or as evidence of ancient technology that was subsequently lost. But one place that the Baghdad Battery has been covered is another mysterious world. But instead of being Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, It was an episode of Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World that came out in 1980. Specifically, it was episode 3, titled Ancient Wisdom. That episode is where we took our opening segment from in today's episode, and we'll hear more from that episode as we go along.
What do we know about the Baghdad Battery?
Well, there isn't a lot of good information about it, at least not that's easily accessible. This is one of the problems with researching the Baghdad Battery online. There don't seem to be a whole lot of books devoted to the subject, and certainly not scholarly ones. So it's mostly just claims you find on web pages and occasionally in newspaper articles, and these aren't always super accurate. Very few authors try to trace the story back to its origin and look up the original scholarly publications. But I found someone who did.
I'm archaeologist Dr. Brad Hafford. I'm a Near Eastern archaeologist. I work primarily in Iraq now. This is the kind of research most people do. If you search for the Baghdad Battery, you're going to find some basic things, but you're not going to find the original data. You've got to dig for that. And so I became more and more interested in it.
And Dr. Hafford did dig up the original sources, no pun intended since he's an archaeologist. Dr. Hafford has a YouTube channel called Artifactually Speaking, and so we'll be hearing from him periodically in today's episode, as he will allow us to cite accurate information and avoid repeating some of the misinformation that you often hear and read about the Baghdad Battery. We'll also have a link to his original video so you can watch the whole thing for yourself.
Let's look at a very basic question. What is the Baghdad Battery, physically, as an object?
It's actually three physical objects that were found together. The largest is a ceramic pot that's about 6 inches tall. The second is a small sheet of copper that has been rolled into a cylinder. And the third is a small rod made of iron. It's sometimes described as a nail, but what we can say with certainty is that it's an iron rod. There also was some asphalt or bitumen that was found with the artifacts, and this apparently served as a stopper at the top of the cylinder. Dr. Hafford explains.
They did all have bitumen, and the bitumen is the way that they sealed this together. Bitumen is just crude oil, really. Iraq has oil, bubbles up from the ground sometimes, becomes very viscous, and they used it in the ancient world as an all-around glue, sometimes as a mortar, and as a waterproofing substance. So it's quite common in use in the ancient world.
According to some reports, the copper tube was found inside the ceramic pot, and the iron rod was found inside the copper tube, or at least inside the ceramic pot. In fact, you often see illustrations of the Baghdad Battery or replicas of it that have been made that have the copper cylinder held in place at the top of the jar by the bitumen stopper, with the iron rod held at the top of the copper cylinder, again by the bitumen. So it's the iron rod inside the copper cylinder inside the ceramic jar. However, it's not 100% clear to me that the artifacts were actually found this way. This is an idealized configuration that you need to put them in order to make them work as a battery. And there were illustrations of them put together like this published early on. The first of these illustrations was made by a man named Wilhelm Koenig, who was the researcher that popularized the idea that they were a battery. So it's not altogether clear to me precisely what configuration the artifacts were found in when they were discovered. It may be that everyone assumed that they were in the configuration you need for a battery because of Koenig's illustration.
How was the Baghdad Battery discovered?
Fortunately, we do know how it was discovered, and it wasn't found in the city of Baghdad itself, but on the outskirts of the city.
I finally found a great resource from 1964 from someone who was working in the National Museum in Iraq. And they gave us the specific information that we're going to need. In the course of earth-moving operations carried out in June 14, 1936, by the Iraq State Railways Department at mile 4/4 on the Baghdad-Bakuba line, where a series of hillocks known locally as Kuyut Rabua, some 2 miles off the Baghdad Eastern Bund, the workman came across an ancient burial covered with a stone slab. So, he's reporting that the earth moving was originally done by the rail department, but not for the building of the railway. This was, as other reports say, it was to get dirt to fill in low-lying areas where mosquitoes were breeding. And they say that they found a grave. They did, but that's why they called in the antiquities department. They then began an excavation of this site, and they say that it's a Parthian settlement. So this tells us that it's on the Baghdad-Bakuba line at 4 miles north of Baghdad.
So the Baghdad Battery was discovered in June 1936 at a site just outside Baghdad called Kuyut Rabwa. It was said to be in the remains of a Parthian settlement, by which they mean a settlement that was part of the Parthian Empire. The Parthian Empire covered a lot of territory, including Iraq and Iran, and it lasted for about 500 years, from 247 BC to AD 224. It was succeeded by the Sasanian Empire, or Second Persian Empire, in AD 224, and the Sasanian Empire lasted just over 400 years until AD 651, when it was conquered by the Muslims. There has been some debate about whether the Baghdad Battery was Parthian or Sasanian. One reason is that the shape of the ceramic jar looks kind of like it might be Sasanian. However, it takes time for pottery styles to change, and so it might be on the fringe of the transition from the Parthian to the Sasanian periods. The early reports indicate that the site where it was found was a Parthian settlement. Dr. Hafford states,
the place they were found was reported as a Parthian settlement, and Parthians were around from roughly 200 BCE to 200 CE. But the best reports I can find tend to say that this is probably late Parthian, so it's closer to that 200 CE date, most likely.
So we'll assume this is correct, and that the Baghdad Battery does date to about AD 200, which would essentially make it 1,800 years old rather than a full 2,000.
Do we know who found the Baghdad Battery?
This is often not mentioned in accounts of it, but Dr. Hafford located a source that indicated who it was. After the railroad company contacted the Department of Antiquities to look at the grave, the department sent two gentlemen, Sharif Yusuf and Jawad al-Safar, to supervise the dig. So as the guys in charge of the dig, they get the credit for discovering it.
We do know who found it in Al-Haik in Sumer 1964, and he was reading the actual reports from the dig in 1936. Now, as far as I can tell, that was never published, but the records that the archaeologists took were kept in the Iraq Museum, and by this 1964 article, he says, people are really interested in this so-called battery, so I'm going to give some more information. And he reports some of the information that came from that original dig. Now, that was 30 years in the past at that point, but it's the best record we have because it seems to be a direct connection. We now have the Iraq Museum numbers of the Baghdad Battery. It has three numbers. Why? Because it's got a jar, it's got a copper cylinder that was in the jar, and it's got an iron rod or nail.
So the battery itself was unearthed in 1936, but it took a couple of years for it to be analyzed. The guy who did that was named Wilhelm Koenig, and you hear different things about him. He was from Vienna, Austria, and sometimes he's described as an archaeologist, but I've heard skeptics say, presumably to diminish his reputation, that he was a painter. And it's true he was an artist, but that doesn't stop you from being an archaeologist. You can do both, just like you can be both an archaeologist and a time traveler. You also sometimes hear about Koenig that he was part of the Baghdad Antiquity Administration and that he was the director of the Iraq Museum, though that's not accurate, at least not in 1938, as we'll hear. And his position may have changed over time, but he did work there and he published in scholarly journals, so he had actual expertise in Iraqi antiquities. In 1938, he published a paper on the Baghdad Battery. Dr. Hafford states,
it was analyzed by Wilhelm Koenig in 1938. He published a short article about it in German. That's the earliest record that I can find. And most people don't read that one because it's old, it's harder to find, and it's in German. He was not the director of the museum, though. He was the director of the museum's laboratory. And he really wanted to believe they were batteries. So, yeah, he started the kind of concept.
The title of Koenig's paper translates into English as a galvanic element from the Parthian period, ? And a galvanic cell is another way of saying a chemical battery. So you can hear how even in this 1938 paper, he was speculating that it was a battery. This idea then got some traction in the archaeological community, which brings us back to the 1980 episode of Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World.
This man, Dr. Arne Egebrecht, director of a West German museum, has no doubt at all that there is at least one astonishing example of ancient technology which is 2,000 years ahead of its time. He found it in an exhibition of treasures from ancient Iraq, a pottery jar, a copper cylinder, and an iron rod discovered in Baghdad. He believes they are components of an electric battery, made 2,000 years before batteries were invented in the West.
I decided to check it, and for that purpose, we got made a replica. Here you see the replica, the Baghdad battery. You see here a ceramic pot, you see a copper cylinder, and you see the iron rod here. All replicas. Now I have here a voltmeter. And this voltmeter shows on the scale a distance from 0, a quarter of a volt, to half a volt here, which we should reach by this battery. For that purpose, I combine now the voltmeter and the battery with these wires. Now, one wire is fixed to the rod, the other one is fixed to the copper cylinder. To get it to work, we need only some acid. And for that purpose, a bunch of grapes should help us and should do it. Here I have the grapes and here a glass. And in this, I'm putting now some of the grapes. And with a wooden stick, I am pressing the juice out of it. I hope I get enough so that we see on the scale how the voltmeter is working.
The grape acid battery delivers almost half a volt.
And that's true. In the video, Dr. Egebrecht is using a voltmeter that goes from 0 to 1/2 volts. And as soon as he starts pouring the grape juice into the replica Baghdad battery, the needle immediately starts swinging upward to almost the 0.5 volt level. It looks like it's cranking out 0.4 volts.
That's not very much of an electric charge. A standard AAA battery generates 3 times that much, and you'd need many times that amount, sometimes hundreds of times that amount, to run a standard light bulb. Even with the more efficient low voltage LED lights that we have now, you still need multiple times that. What were the ancient Parthians supposed to be doing with the Baghdad battery?
Well, that's a real question. It's true that half a volt is not much of a charge, and this is something that advocates of some of the wilder ideas about the Baghdad battery representing advanced technology haven't really taken into account. This is not an advanced battery by modern standards. It would be an extremely simple, primitive battery at best. So you're not going to be doing anything high tech with it, you know, like flying hovercrafts or something. I mean, you know, nothing high tech by modern standards. It's possible that you could chain multiple copies of the Baghdad battery together to get a bigger charge. This is like when you have to put multiple flashlight batteries in an old style flashlight to give it enough power to light up. And you could, in principle, chain any number of Baghdad batteries together, but even then, you're not going to be doing very much.
Are there ideas that you've heard about what it or a set of such batteries might have been used for?
One idea I've heard suggested, at least as a joke, is that you might use the batteries to give people a little electric shock, perhaps to convince them that the supernatural is real as part of a ritual ceremony. On this idea, the battery would have had a ritual use, you know, like, come up here and hold these metal wires and I'll show you my power or the power of the gods or whatever. Maybe even the power of God, since many Parthians were Zoroastrians and thus monotheists. However, that's not the most common explanation I've heard. The second idea I've heard goes back to Wilhelm Koenig himself. He noticed that they had some objects that had been discovered that had been plated, which is when you cover an object with a thin layer of metal. like some women today wear jewelry that has been plated with silver or gold, even though underneath that thin layer is a different metal. And there's even a special name for it when you apply a thin layer of gold to something. That's known as gilding. Well, one way of doing metal plating is with an electric current. That's known as electroplating. And after Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World showed Dr. Egebrecht demonstrating his replica battery with a voltmeter, they then showed him running an experiment to see if he could electroplate an object.
Could it have been used for gilding ancient treasure?
To show you that this can be done with this battery, I prepared an experiment.
The technique may have been to immerse a small silver statuette in a gold cyanide solution and electroplate it. The implications for museum directors are chilling. Treasures they always assumed to be solid gold may merely have been gilded. And indeed, in a matter of minutes, the bottom half of this silver statuette acquires the sheen of gold.
This experiment shows that it is possible to do it, and that also in ancient times it might have been possible to have these batterings used for such gold plating processes.
If this is indeed an electric battery, well, one can only register astonishment, because it's 2,000 years ahead of its time. Still, it's possible we have completely misinterpreted its function. It may be something quite different, like a container for scrolls.
We'll talk more about the idea that it was used to contain scrolls later, but Dr. Egebrecht did demonstrate that it's possible you could use something like the Baghdad battery to electroplate artifacts.
Where is the Baghdad battery today? We have more advanced forensic tests today than back in 1980. Could we take a look at it and determine whether it contained the kind of acid needed to function as a battery?
Unfortunately, here we encounter another mystery, because we don't know where the Baghdad battery is today. In April 2003, just a month after the U.S. invaded Iraq, the Iraq Museum was looted and lots of artifacts were stolen, broken, or otherwise lost. I've seen reports that the Baghdad battery was one of the artifacts that was stolen, but Dr. Hofford has this to say about that idea.
I can't confirm that. I've got no access to the databases that were created, and the records in the Iraq National Museum were largely destroyed in that looting. So it's been very difficult to make a good inventory. They're still working on it. I know Colonel Bogdanos made a database that was as complete as he could make it. The University of Chicago has a database that talks about many of the missing things in order to be able to tell what's coming back in. But there was one thing, and I think the Guardian said that it was taken, but was it? How do they know? More likely, it got broken or destroyed in the looting, I think. And was it with the others? Not all of them are in Baghdad anyway. Some are in Germany. The six from Ctesiphon, I think at least some of them, are there. In fact, Pastore did analyze them in the 1980s, and he did a good job. So I think that the problem here is we're not looking at all of the evidence that we have.
And though most people don't look at the evidence, that won't stop us from looking at it and seeing what we can determine.
And before we do that, let's take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including David R., Cyprian C., Ron B., Damian M., and Gene L. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is also brought to you by DeliverContacts.com, offering top brand contact lenses at always low prices with free delivery. Visit DeliverContacts.com. And by Rosary Army, featuring award-winning Catholic podcasts, rosary resources, videos, and the School of Mary online community, prayer, and learning platform. Learn how to make them, pray them, and give them away while growing in your faith at RosaryArmy.com and SchoolofMary.com. So, Jimmy, what theories are there about the Baghdad battery?
There are several we need to consider. First, there's the theory that it was used to electroplate objects. Second, there's the theory that it was used as a battery. Third, there's the theory that it was used to just hold scrolls. And fourth, there's the theory that it had a completely different function. Before we get to those theories, though, we're going to look at how batteries work, because that's something a lot of people don't know, and it has a bearing on our mystery today.
First, though, is there anything to say about the Baghdad battery from the faith perspective?
Not really. Batteries are just energy storage devices, and they don't have too much of an intersection with the faith. As mankind learned about battery technology, it revealed new aspects of God's creation and how it works. It has allowed mankind to improve its own condition. Batteries, including ones that are part of our electrical power grid, have brought many benefits to mankind, and all that brings glory to God in the same way other technologies do, but that's about it. So if it turned out that chemical batteries were invented during the Parthian Empire, it wouldn't really change things from the faith perspective.
Then let's shift to the reason perspective. You said that we'd discuss how batteries work, but when were they invented?
The predecessors of modern batteries are what are known as Leyden jars. These were invented in 1745 by the German inventor Ewald George von Kleist, who was a deacon in a Protestant religious order. Yes, they had Protestant religious orders. But Leyden jars aren't actually batteries. They're capacitors, and they work on a different principle. Unlike batteries, they store electricity and then release their charge all at once, instead of giving you a flow of current. People soon got the idea of chaining a group of Leyden jars together, and these chains were given a name by the American inventor Benjamin Franklin, the only president of the United States who was never president of the United States. In the military, when you group a bunch of guns together, like cannons and other types of artillery guns, that group is called a battery. So despite the fact that they were actually capacitors, Ben Franklin referred to a chain or group of Leyden jars as an electrical battery. And the name eventually was transferred to what we now call a battery. What we now call a battery was originally called a pile. And they were invented in the 1790s by the Italian inventor Alessandro Volta, which is where we get the name for the electrical unit, the volt. Volta discovered that you could generate a steady electric current by piling up disks of different metals on top of each other, separated by saltwater-soaked cloths. And this steady current was much more useful than the all-at-once electrical release you got from Leyden jars. Today, the kind of device that Volta invented are known as voltaic piles, and they are an early form of battery. So since they were invented around 1800, the Baghdad battery preceded their invention by about 1600 years, if it dates from AD 200, and if it is a battery.
So how do voltaic piles and other batteries work?
Electrical current is basically a flow of electrons, as you might guess from the name electron. Electrons are negatively charged, and since opposites attract, negatively charged electrons will flow towards something that's positively charged. Here's an explainer from SciShow that discusses a classic science fair project, how to make a battery using a lemon.
The important thing to note here, the electricity is not in the lemon. First, let's do this thing. Now roll the lemon around a bit to break up all the little juice packets inside, get it nice and juicy. Stick a nail in one side, it has to be a galvanized nail, meaning it's coated in zinc. And on the other side, stick something copper. I'm using copper wire. You'll probably be unsurprised to discover that when I connect this voltmeter to the copper and the zinc, it will show some electric current. Electrochemical cells, also called batteries, require three things. Two electrodes and one electrolyte. One of the electrodes has to have a stronger desire for electrons than the other. In chemistry, we say that it has a higher electronegativity. That electrode, the one that wants the electrons more, is called the cathode. And the one that gives up electrons is called the anode. In our lemon battery here, we have copper in the wire and zinc from this galvanized nail. Copper likes having electrons more than zinc, so it's more electronegative and thus our cathode. But if that's the case, then why can't we just hook the copper to the zinc and watch the electrons zoom across? And what's the point of the lemon? Electrons aren't just going to abandon their nice stable home and make the metal all positively charged on one side and negative on the other. There are a ton of forces that prevent that from happening. Since zinc is losing all those electrons, it's going to have to lose protons too, and that's where the third component comes in, the electrolyte. The wire that connects the copper and the zinc allows electrons to flow freely, but protons are huge compared to electrons, and they can't move through wires. That's not a thing that happens. But they can move into an ionic solution. An ionic solution like a dilution of citric acid. And that is our electrolyte. When zinc is exposed to the acid in the lemon juice, the acid oxidizes or removes electrons from the zinc, and the resulting positively charged zinc ions move into solution. The resulting electrons, they collect in the metal and then rush across the wire into the copper, which, if you remember, wants electrons more than zinc does. Those electrons now in the copper pull a couple of protons or hydrogen ions out of the acid and reduce them, adding electrons. The result is hydrogen gas, which if we were in there, we might be able to see as very, very tiny bubbles forming on the copper electrode. In summary, the electricity is coming not from the lemon, but from a chemical reaction resulting from the differences in electronegativities between zinc and copper. The electrons would rather be in the copper, and the lemon juice opens a door for them to get there. Want some proof? Well, oftentimes you'll see lemon battery experiments using multiple lemons connected in series to give you more power. But you don't actually need to do that. If I push in three nails and three copper wires in the same lemon, I get roughly three times as much electric current. As long as there's enough space in the lemon and enough lemon juice, the power is in the zinc, not in the lemon.
Now, you don't have to use copper and zinc, as in that experiment. You can use other materials, like the copper cylinder and the iron rod in the Baghdad battery. What you need for this type of battery is two metals with different amounts of electronegativity, and then you need an electrolyte to connect them. An electrolyte being a medium that contains electrically charged atoms or ions. It's what allows the electricity to flow from one metal to the other, which is why Dr. Egebrecht had to add grape juice to his replica of the Baghdad battery so that the electricity could flow between the iron rod and the copper cylinder it contained. So that's how chemical batteries work in general, and that's how the Baghdad battery worked when Dr. Egebrecht gave his demonstration.
Then let's start looking at the theories you mentioned. First, there was the theory that it was used to electroplate objects, like Dr. Egebrecht demonstrated was possible with his second experiment. How well has this proposal stood up?
Not particularly well. It's true that we've discovered ancient metal-plated objects in Iraq. There are objects dated from the right time frame to have a small, thin coating of metal, which is what led Wilhelm Koenig to propose that they might have been electroplated using things like the Baghdad battery. But here's the problem. Electroplating is just one way of plating an object. There are others, like hammering out a metal really thinly and then applying it to the exterior of an object. And in the years since 1938, the plated objects that we have from ancient Iraq have been reviewed, and it turns out they weren't electroplated. BBC News reports.
Two main techniques of gilding were used at the time and are still in use today. Hammering the precious metal into thin strips using brute force, or mixing it with a mercury base, which is then pasted over the article. These techniques are effective but wasteful compared with the addition of a small but consistent layer of metal by electrodeposition. The ability to mysteriously electroplate gold or silver onto such objects would not only save precious resources and money, but could also win you important friends at court. One serious flaw with the electroplating hypothesis for the Baghdad battery is the lack of items from this place and time that have been treated in this way. The examples we see from this region and era are conventional gild plating and mercury gilding, says Dr. Craddock. There's never been any untouchable evidence to support the electroplating theory.
So the problem for the idea that the Baghdad battery was used to electroplate objects is that we don't have any electroplated ones from this place and period. We have ones that used hammered gilding, and we have ones that use the mercury gilding process, but we don't have any that were electroplated. As a result, Dr. Hafford states,
the electroplating theory doesn't really hold water. Electroplating, I think it's because people were reaching for that purpose. Why would you need a battery? And we do have plating of objects. There's other ways to do that.
So, yeah, it doesn't look like the Baghdad battery was used for electroplating.
Then let's look at the question of whether it was even a battery. We have been referring to it as the Baghdad battery the whole show because that's how people talk about it. But doesn't that prejudice the issue?
It does. It puts the idea that it's a battery in your head up front, and that can prevent you from taking a fresh, objective look at the evidence and asking what the object really is. This is something that others have commented on as well.
It's not a good name. To call it a battery means you know it's a battery. And in fact, we don't know that. The more I've researched, the less I believe it. I really wanted to believe that it is battery in it, and it could have been. The people were smart enough to make one, but I don't think they did. It could be called the Parthian jars, and I think that that's not a bad name, because that's essentially what they are.
Another problem with prejudicing the issue is that people are imagining the Baghdad battery in an ideal configuration where it has been set up to be a battery. You've got the exterior ceramic pot with the copper tube inserted and held in place by the bitumen. And inside that, you've got the iron rod held in place by the bitumen. And you poured in some kind of acid in, you know, into the ceramic jar to serve as an electrolyte. It's true that, well, given all those things, it will function as a battery. But that doesn't show us that this is what the ancient Parthians did with it. And we have to ask ourselves the question of whether we're simply taking modern concepts and pressing them inappropriately onto ancient objects. But if you know the principles that are used in a simple device, like the Richard Dean Anderson TV character MacGyver, I mean, couldn't you do something like this? It's easy to grab some seemingly random items and improvise a version of that device. I mean, think about it. The Richard Dean Anderson TV character MacGyver, who's famed for coming up with improvised devices, could, in a pinch, run into your kitchen, grab a lemon and a copper penny and a nail, and MacGyver you a battery on the spot using apparently random objects. So is that what we're doing with the Baghdad battery? Based on our modern knowledge of what you could use these three artifacts for, plus some acid, are we MacGyvering ourselves an ancient battery out of objects that simply didn't have this function?
Koenig definitely wanted to believe it was a battery. And he said that if you put some form of acid into that copper cylinder with the iron sticking into it, you would get a charge. And you would. So he wanted to believe that. And other people thought, wow, this is a great idea. So, yeah, it caught on. And then some engineers or people who look at that and say, from the drawings that Koenig made and everything, yes, that could be a battery. And then they make copies of that, of the idealized thing, and find out that it can give a charge. So yes, if all of these other things are true, it could have been a battery. It can function as a battery if you construct it in the idealized way. See, that's, I think, the problem. Once Koenig decided it was a battery and he did the drawing to show that the copper cylinder would be in there and then the iron rod would go inside, then yes, people ran with that.
Is there any way to figure out whether the ancient Parthians were using it as a battery?
There are several potential lines of evidence we can check. First, if it was functioning as a battery, then we need to find evidence of the electrolyte. All we have at the moment are two possible electrodes, the copper cylinder and the iron rod, but they don't give you a battery unless you have an electrolyte like an acid connecting them. So we could look at the bottom of the ceramic jar and see if there's any residue of an acid.
Since the objects are now lost and possibly destroyed, did anyone do that previously?
You will occasionally see a claim that acid residue was found in the jar, but nobody seems to have been able to document this. It's just a claim that's floating around out there. And given the amount of misinformation about the artifact, we really need documentation. Further, there was a study done in the 1980s that found some lead carbonates, which likely resulted from lead that was deteriorating due to groundwater seeping through the object. but that's not the same thing as acid corrosion.
Koenig never says that. He did not have proof of acid. So there's another very good article written by Emmerich Pastori in 1985. It was written in German, so a lot of people aren't reading it, but it analyzes all of the evidence, and it does a great job. He did some scientific analysis of these objects after an exhibit in Germany that included the Baghdad battery and other versions of it. And when he analyzed it, he did find lead carbonates, which are deterioration products from the lead. He never talks about an acid corrosion, and no one really does. There's one mention that says after the war, meaning World War II, someone looked at this and found acid corrosion. They'll refer to an experiment, and they won't tell you what was found or how it was done. You have to have the experiment and be able to understand that it was using good techniques or whatever. So there we go.
So we don't have good evidence of the jar being used to hold an acid, and the 1980s study seems to point the other way. There are also other problems. For example, you'll recall that in the demonstration that we saw from Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, Dr. Egebrecht had to connect wires to his replica battery. You have to connect one wire to the copper cylinder, which is one electrode, and you have to connect another wire to the iron rod, which is the other electrode. If you can't do that, then the current won't flow. But there would be problems doing this with the Baghdad battery.
You would then need to make sure that the bitumen holds it in place so much that you can still get a contact on the copper and a contact on the iron. Those were completely covered with bitumen, and in some cases, they were inside the neck of the jar. And we don't have any wires to make those contacts anyway, so the logistics on this thing, they just wouldn't work.
So not only were the artifacts not found with the wires that you'd need to complete an electric circuit, attaching the wires would apparently be impossible because the two supposed electrodes were covered with bitumen.
Dr. Hafford said that in some cases, the connection would have been inside the neck of the jar. What's he talking about?
Okay, here comes one of the twists for this episode. One of the best ways to figure out what an ancient object is to compare it with other similar objects. These are known as comparanda, or things that are to be compared. So the so-called Baghdad battery was found in 1936 at a site near Baghdad called Kuyut Rabuwa. And in 1938, when Wilhelm Koenig was analyzing the Baghdad battery, he looked around to see if there were any comparable objects to study. And there were.
There are comparanda for the Baghdad battery, and they tend to come from the Sasanian period, which is just after the Parthian, up to about 650 CE. All right, here's the biggest mistake that we all make. I made it when I was talking about it on the podcast. If you type this in and you try to do some research on the Baghdad battery, they're going to tell you it was found in a group of four. It was not. The one from Kuyut Rabuwa in 1936 was found on its own. There was only one from that site. Across the river Tigris from Ctesiphon is the site called Seleucia. Now, that was dug by Leroy Waterman. And in 1930, he reports four of these jars, very much like the so-called Baghdad battery. Now, when Koenig talked about this in 1938, he talks about the one that he was analyzing, and then he goes and he looks for comparanda, similar objects that probably served a similar function. And he found these four that Waterman had excavated in 1930. So that's why people conflate it. They read, or maybe they read someone who has read this, or they're getting secondary or tertiary reports and not going to the original. So in the original German, he says, got this one. Okay, here's these other four I'm going to compare them to. So I went and found Waterman's original reports. And that tells us a great deal about the fine spot of the four that everybody thinks are the Baghdad batteries. Now, let's read a little bit of that. The sealed jar is one of four examples found during the closing days of the 1930 season at Trowel Trench 30. All are small jars from 6 to 8 inches in height of very common unglazed ware, but of different types. Two have a handle, and the other two have none. All were sealed with bitumen stoppers, and each was held in place by small rods set upright at the ends and sides. These rods were from 6 to 10 inches long and projected slightly above the jars. Each jar had one iron rod, the rest being of bronze. Each of the three horizontally placed jars contained a small bronze cylinder originally sealed at both ends. Each cylinder originally contained what appears as a tightly wrapped roll, though in one instance, owing to the loosening of the ends of the cylinder, the contents had become a mass of mere flakes. A second roll had partially disintegrated so that only a small, closely wrapped core is preserved. The third appears to be intact and gives the impression of a roll of paper folded over at the ends. There you go. We've got all three of the ones that are lying down. They have papyrus inside the copper roll. And all of them have spikes holding the jar in place. They're on the edges and sticking up above the jar to hold them down. So this is a very interesting analysis that nobody talks about. Talking about the Seleucia ones now, and none of those had an iron rod inside. Only the one at Kuyurabuwa had that. Three of them had copper cylinders, and all three of those had papyrus. The one that didn't have a copper cylinder had the remains of a glass flask in it. And it was standing upright. The others were all laying down.
So several years earlier in 1930, four similar ceramic jars were found at the nearby site of Seleucia. Each one of them was held in place by metal rods. Each of the jars had a single iron rod holding it in place, and the other rods were bronze. One of the jars contained the remains of a glass bottle, the other three had copper cylinders, and the copper cylinders had papyrus in them. We'll also soon hear about additional finds like this. Given all that, these are very close to the so-called Baghdad Battery, and they should have performed the same function.
I think these are functionally the same. They just have some variations. They're not identical. Even at the Seleucia ones, two of them were missing that neck. Basically, this is a fairly common jar type in the Sasanian period. It's piriform. It comes up like a pear and comes over to a shoulder and then up to a very narrow neck. And that neck has a handle on it. Well, if you break that neck off, you get what looks like what we're showing here is a Baghdad jar or Baghdad battery. We've got the copper in them. We've got the bitumen in them and the papyrus in them. So I think it's not right to say that they are functionally different.
So that explains what Dr. Hafford was talking about when he referred to the neck of the jars. These jars were originally shaped like pears, but with a longer, thin neck with a handle at the top of the pear shape, except that the shape was fragile and got knocked off in some cases, such as with the Baghdad battery, which is why it appears to be shaped like a pear. It's just the surviving lower half of a more vase-like jar. And this explains Dr. Hafford's comments about the bitumen plug being down in the neck of the jars. If these were functioning as batteries, not only was the bitumen plug covering the two electrodes that you need to attach wires to, but the plug itself was down in the neck of the original object, making it hard to reach. So this is a very impractical setup for a battery, and between that and the lack of evidence for an electrolyte, it makes it quite unlikely that any of these objects were ever used as a battery. We've just MacGyvered that idea into place based on modern knowledge of what you could do with these materials. However, now that we have comparable objects, we need to look at all of them together to figure out their function.
Earlier, we heard Arthur C. Clarke speculate that if the Baghdad battery wasn't a battery, it may have been used to hold scrolls. And now we've heard that the other jars held papyrus. That leads us to the third theory, that the Baghdad battery was a scroll holder. What do you make of that theory?
The idea of putting scrolls in ceramic jars is not at all unreasonable. In fact, we know that ceramic jars were sometimes used to store scrolls. Papyrus, which is a kind of paper made out of reeds, is a fragile substance. It can easily get damaged, including by water, and the ink used to write on it can get washed off or otherwise messed up. Meanwhile, ceramic jars are good, convenient sources of protection, and we know that people in the ancient world did sometimes store scrolls in ceramic jars. One way we know that is that the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were written and deposited during the time of the Parthian Empire, were stored in jars to protect them. And if you go to a Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit in a museum today, they'll often show you one of the jars or a replica of one of them as part of the exhibit. By the way, We talked about the Dead Sea Scrolls in general way back in episode 9 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So you can go to mysterious.fm/9 to listen to that. We also talked about the mystery of the Copper Scroll in episode 35. And you can go to mysterious.fm/35 to hear my theory, which I've never heard anyone else propose, about what the Copper Scroll actually is. In any event, the idea of putting scrolls in ceramic jars for protection is not at all unreasonable. But that doesn't appear to be the case with the Baghdad Battery and the comparable objects. Because if you want to use a jar to protect scrolls so that you can, you know, take them out and read them later, then you don't seal it closed with asphalt. That's going to make it impossible to get the scrolls out again. So a mere scroll holder theory does not work.
Then that would leave us with the fourth possibility, that the Baghdad Battery had a completely different function. Can we figure out what that would be?
Yes. It was a ritual object that had a ritual function.
We do have a joke amongst archaeologists that when we don't know what something is, we will call it ritual. But that, too, is a warning to us. We don't do that in academic publications. We're never going to say, well, this was ritual, unless we have absolute evidence of it. And ritual did exist. That's the bigger point. Sometimes you can prove that something was ritual because of the context. And there are even writings in cuneiform that tell us about magic in the ancient world, or the beliefs of spirits and things like this. And, you know, in fact, the best interpretation of the Baghdad Battery type is that it's a ritual object, not ever a battery, not used in that sense. That's not what the theory is. It's not to keep papyrus dry so that you can take it out and either read it or write on it or anything like that. Instead, it's all about putting in small written slips of paper in a ritual way. Now, I know that many people are going to say, oh, that's a cop-out, but it's not. We've got so much evidence for this that, in fact, we have to go with the interpretation because it's the best evidence we've got.
And Dr. Hafford is right about that. I'll tell you what convinced me that the Baghdad Battery is a ritual object. It was when I learned that the comparable artifacts were discovered in the foundation of an ancient building. Now, even today, we have rituals associated with buildings. For example, there's the famous groundbreaking ceremony where you get a bunch of people together, often with gold-plated shovels, and they dig the first spadefuls of earth for a new building project. We also sometimes put time capsules into the foundation of a building or its cornerstone so future generations can see objects from our time. That's a kind of ritual, too. Or, once the building is finished, you have the grand opening ribbon-cutting ceremony.
We still do things like this today sometimes. We have people that go to open buildings. You know, the mayor comes out with the big golden scissors and cuts the ribbon. It's a ritual, a ceremony. We still have those, and those giant scissors are a material correlate. If an archaeologist found those, what would they think? That there was a giant around here using scissors? Why were they golden? Well, because it's a ritual.
Well, they had rituals connected with buildings in the ancient world, too. Only whereas our groundbreaking time capsule and ribbon cutting ceremonies today are essentially secular rituals, the ones they had in the ancient world were religious in nature. Some would even say that they had magic functions. But as we covered back in episode 79 on religion, magic, psychic phenomena, and science, magic is best understood just as an unauthorized ritual, such as a ritual from someone else's religion. So I'll be more charitable and just note that the ceremonies performed with the foundations of buildings in the ancient world were religious rituals. In any event, it was when I learned that the four other jars were discovered in the foundation of a building that everything really clicked into place for me. I realized that they were foundation deposits, and ancient foundation deposits were ritual. Think about it. You've got a small piece of papyrus, undoubtedly with something written on it. You roll it up and you put it in a jar. Then you seal the jar with an asphalt plug, and then you put the jar in the foundation of a building. You aren't using the jar to protect the scroll so you can read it again later. You're not planning to read that scroll again. You've deposited it in the foundation of a building, so you can't read it. And it's now fulfilling a ritual function.
Then who's supposed to read what you wrote on the scroll?
God, or the gods, or the spirits, the people that you talk to in rituals. And you're going to ask them for one of two things. Either you're going to ask them for help for yourself or blessings, or you're going to ask them for harm for others or curses. This doesn't just happen with foundation deposits. People all over the ancient world would write down their prayers, either blessings for themselves or curses for their enemies, as a way of asking God or the gods or the spirits for their help. And then they would dispose of the written texts in a ceremonial way. For example, we have something like 1,600 objects that are known in Latin as defixiones, or curse tablets. What you do is get a thin sheet of lead and write a curse on it. You would then commonly ask the spirits to pierce or bind the person that you were cursing. Then you'd roll it up, the tablet, or fold it up. You'd likely pierce it with a nail to make the point that you really want the cursed person pierced with a curse. And this is actually where defixiones got their name. In Latin, defigere means to nail. And then you'd put the now activated curse tablet somewhere underground, like a tomb or a well or an underground shrine, or you might nail it to the wall of an above ground temple. In the video version of this podcast, we're going to have a picture of a curse tablet that was found at the city of Bath in England, where they had famous baths that people would go to bathe in. Guess why we call them baths? The curse on this tablet reads,
"May he who carried off Vilbia from me become liquid as the water. May she who so obscenely devoured her become mute."
This tablet from Bath is a curse tablet that is branching out into love magic. And you do sometimes find curse tablets with love spells on them. Only the love magic is more curse related than you might guess. Ancient love magic was much more rough than you might imagine. It wasn't just, "Let Vilbia fall in love with me." Instead, it was more like, "Let Vilbia fall in love with me, and if she doesn't, then may her insides burn and her lungs suffer and her hair fall out and her eyes go blind for every minute she doesn't love me." So they were very serious about their love spells and kind of brutal about it. In any event, small written prayers, either for blessings or curses, were common in ancient rituals, and they are frequently contained in foundation deposits, especially requests for blessings, because you'd normally want the people using the building to be blessed and protected. Dr. Hafford discusses all of this in connection with the Baghdad Battery and the other objects that were found.
So, first of all, many more of them than just the one had papyrus in them. Many of them did. And secondly, we have texts that tell us about doing this kind of thing. Basically, what it is you write spells out on paper. You do it on lead, sometimes little thin lead sheets. And you roll that up and you put it into usually a subterranean environment because it's going to be sent to the gods. There's two things you want to do. First of all, protect yourself from evil, or maybe send evil to other people's way. There are very thin lead sheets with curses written on them. About 1,600 of them have been found from Greece out to Roman Britain. And that's exactly what they were doing. They would write, "Curse my neighbor," because, you know, and then they would wrap it up and they'd throw it in a well, or they might bury it, or... This is a ritual, magical context. We've got fantastic evidence from that context of find of the four at Seleucia. We know they were found together. They were found in a rectangular foundation of a building, and that's a ritual context. In foundation deposits, you will sometimes get these things to protect the building and the people who live in that building. And the three that were found were on their sides. They have these nails around them. Texts tell us the importance of nails to send the spell home. Even metaphorically, you can see that this anchors it. You can nail things together and it holds them. Well, the iron nail binds the spell. The best evidence, though, I think here is not necessarily just the fact that these things have the copper cylinders. And in fact, they don't always have just a single cylinder. One of them had 3 cylinders in it. Another one had 10 cylinders in it. Very small. These were all blessings, probably.
And that's true. Having 6 or 10 copper cylinders containing papyrus shoved down into the jar makes no sense in the context of a battery. You need any copper cylinders up at the top of the jar held in place by the asphalt plug so that you could attach wires to them. But 3 or 10 copper cylinders containing papyrus can all logically be shoved down into the jar if they contain prayers, like prayers for blessings on the people who use the building or curses for anyone who might harm those people. There's also another very convincing piece of evidence that these artifacts had a ritual purpose. And that's the fact that they weren't the only foundation deposits. They were found in the presence of another kind of foundation deposit that is known to have a ritual purpose. And these are what are known as incantation bowls. And so far, 2,000 known incantation bowls have been registered as archaeological finds, although it's estimated that there may well be thousands of more of them that have been found that are in the hands of private collectors and haven't been registered. Incantation bowls were very common in the ancient Near East. And in my biblical studies, I've seen, for example, you know, books with pictures of texts of Jewish incantation bowls and translations of the incantations on them. I'll let Dr. Hafford explain further.
The 4 that were found at Seleucia were also found in the same context with what some people call magic bowls. But Waterman, who found them and these 4 Baghdad batteries, reports them as incantation bowls, which is a much better term. It's one we often use. So an incantation bowl is a shallow bowl that's usually found upside down, and inside it are written spells. They're usually spiraling down, and sometimes there's a drawing of a demon in chains, because that's what the bowl does. It traps a demon. You put it underneath your threshold, so if anything evil, spirit, tries to come into your house, it gets sucked into the bowl and trapped. So that's ritual, and it's telling me it's ritual. We're not making this up. They're functioning together with the incantation bowls in this context. It's the best context we have.
And I agree with that. The fact that the Baghdad battery-like jars were foundation deposits, that they were constructed in a way that makes sense for ritual objects, and that they were found with incantation bowls, all that tells us that this is what they were. They were ritual objects. But a diehard battery fan, no pun intended, might make an objection.
You could say, well, that's not the one from Kuyut Rabwa. That one was a battery. These things are magical jars. You could say that. I can't prove otherwise. But if we only have the one battery and we can't find anything else that is the same, then we could make anything up about it. So we have to find comparenda. We've got to take that jar and say, are there other jars like it? Yes, there are. Not only there are other jars that are like it, there are jars that have similar contents. They've got copper cylinders in them. They've got bitumen in there sealing them off. Many of them have the papyrus. And outside those laying down jars, there were rods, and one of them was iron. And the texts tell us that iron is often an important one, and the different metals have different meanings. Just because the iron rod is not inside the jar doesn't mean that it's functionally different. It means the ritual was conducted slightly differently, but they still had the same idea behind them. So I think that in the case of the one at Kuyut Rabwa, they probably wrote out the papyrus, wrapped it around the iron, and then stuck it inside the copper, metaphorically anchoring it. The other ones, they did that inside the copper, put the jar down, and then anchored the whole jar around it. It's still the same ritual in general. It's supposed to do the same thing.
And that's correct. We do not have evidence supporting the idea that the Baghdad battery was actually used as a battery. But we do have evidence suggesting that it was what you might call a blessing jar, that it was meant to bring blessings to the people who used a building in ancient Parthia, and so, like other comparable artifacts we have, it would have been included as a foundation deposit.
It sounds like we're headed for a conclusion. Is there anything else you'd like to cover today?
Yeah, and this is just something for fun. Today, we've been talking about chemical batteries and how they work, but there's another type of battery that I've been aware of for some time, but most people have never heard of them, and they're really cool. So I want to explain that kind of battery, too. Now, remember that all a battery is a device that stores energy and that can release it steadily rather than all at once like a capacitor. Well, there are lots of ways to store energy, and they don't all involve chemistry. For example, suppose I take a set of books and put them up on the top shelf of a bookcase. I had to spend energy to raise them all up to that height. But since the law of conservation of energy says that energy is never created or destroyed, it only changes form, well, by putting those books up on the top shelf, I've invested them with energy that still exists. In physics, they have what's called potential energy. And we can release the potential energy of a book by knocking it off the shelf so that gravity causes it to fall and impact the floor with a burst of kinetic energy. We can then generate a steady release of energy if we knock the other books off the shelf one by one. So essentially, my bookshelf filled with books is a battery. It stores potential energy that is then released and converted into kinetic energy due to the force of gravity, making it what's known as a gravity battery. And all you need to do to turn the kinetic energy into electricity is add a turbine.
This is a battery, but so is this. Here's where things get really interesting. Chemical batteries aren't the only way to store energy. In fact, some of the biggest batteries in the world are actually lakes. About an hour outside of Los Angeles is Pyramid Lake. This lake stores energy, enough energy to power up to 83,000 homes in a day. But it doesn't work like the chemical batteries we've talked about so far. Instead, it stores energy as gravitational potential energy. So here's how it works. Pyramid Lake is part of what's called a pumped storage hydropower plant. These kinds of plants store energy by moving water between two reservoirs at different heights. When energy demand is low, or there's a lot of unused power being generated by renewable sources, that excess energy is used to pump the lake water up into the higher reservoir. Here, hundreds of thousands of gallons of water are pumped 7.5 miles uphill from the lake below through six gigantic pipes, 30 feet in diameter. Then, when more energy is needed, a valve is opened and gravity causes the water to flow back downhill through the same pipes, converting the stored or potential energy to kinetic energy. This flow is used to turn massive turbines, which generate electricity, just as they would in a typical hydroelectric plant. We can calculate the potential energy this water has by multiplying the mass of the water by the acceleration of gravity by the change in height. We get a potential energy of almost 6.7 times 10 to the 14th joules, meaning the lake could theoretically generate 190 million kilowatt hours of energy. Now, the facility in Los Angeles is just one of many across the world. The United States currently has 42 facilities that can store around 21,000 megawatts. And the one here at Pyramid Lake can supply electricity to around 83,000 houses in a day.
So gravity batteries are some of the largest batteries in the world, and they're fully rechargeable and don't require a lot of maintenance or wear down over time the way that rechargeable chemical batteries do. And you don't need a liquid like water to have a gravity battery. You can make them with solids, too.
There are a lot of other methods being proposed to store energy generated by sustainable sources. Compressed air, heavy weights lifted up mine shafts, and pressurized water are just some of what's being proposed. Imagine using energy to lift a weight high up in a mine shaft, storing that energy as potential energy. Let the weight fall back down, turning a turbine as it goes, and you can recapture that energy when you need it. There's even a Swiss company proposing to store electricity as gravitational energy by building giant towers of 35-ton composite blocks. In reality, it's not that different from what they're doing at Pyramid Lake. Unconventional? Maybe. But personally, I am okay with giant energy storage Jenga.
And I am too. Gravity batteries are just cool. And given how much energy they can store and their other advantages, as well as society's increasing power needs, they very well may represent a key part of the future of batteries.
Cool. Anything else you want to say before we close?
Just a reminder that I'm going to be teaching the Introduction to Parapsychology course at the Ryan Education Center this May and June. The Ryan asked me to teach their online Introduction to Parapsychology course last fall, and it was a big success. So the Ryan has asked me to teach the course again, and I hope you'll join me. It's an 8-week course that will be offered live in May and June, but you don't have to be there live because all the lectures will be recorded and you'll actually have up to 6 months to watch them at your leisure. You can either take you can either audit the course, meaning you just watch the lectures for your own interest and information, or you can take it for a grade, in which case you'll get a special certificate signed by me if you pass. It's a fascinating course that any Mysterious World fan would love, and so I hope you'll sign up. Furthermore, the Ryan has also asked me to teach a course on Christianity and parapsychology this August, and a course on world religions and parapsychology this fall. So by taking the Intro to Parapsychology course now, you could be in a better position to get the most out of the religion themed courses that I'll be teaching later in the year. Just go to Ryan, that's RHINE.edu.org to learn more. Once again, RHINE.edu.org.
So, Jimmy, what's your bottom line on the Baghdad Battery?
The Baghdad Battery is an interesting set of artifacts. They appear to date from the end of the Parthian Empire around AD 200, and the idea that they were originally a battery gained some support in the scholarly community. The objects can be made to function as a battery, but they were probably not used to electroplate anything, and they probably weren't used as a battery at all. Instead, based on comparable objects and how they were found, the Baghdad Battery appears to be what you could call a blessing jar. That is, a foundation deposit of a ritual nature that was meant to bring blessings or protection to the people who used an ancient Parthian building, which is interesting in and of itself. And while the Baghdad Battery does not appear to have met electrical needs in the past, many of the electrical needs of the future may be met by gravity batteries.
So, Jimmy, what further resources can we offer to the viewers and listeners?
We'll have a link to where you can find out about my course on the Introduction to Parapsychology at the Ryan Education Center, Dr. Brad Hafford's Artifactually Speaking episode on the Baghdad Battery, also a video of Chariots of the Gods and Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World episode 3, Ancient Wisdom, SciShow's explanation on how to make a lemon battery, BBC News on the electroplating theory, information about curse tablets, a reactions video on gravity batteries, and more information in text form about gravity batteries.
And now it's time to hear from you. What are your theories about the mystery of the Baghdad Battery? You can let us know by visiting sqpn.com or the Jimmy Akins Mysterious World Facebook page. Send us an email to feedback@mysterious.fm. Send a tweet to @MYS_world. Visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord or call our Mysterious Feedback line at 619-738-4515. That's 619-738-4515.
And I want to say a special word of thanks to Oasis Studio 7 for the video and animation work in this episode. They are available for hire, and you can check out their work by going to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. While you're there, I'd really appreciate it if you help me with my YouTube channel. You can do that by subscribing and hitting the bell notification so you always get a notification whenever I have a new video, usually multiple times a week now. You can also help by liking the video and by commenting on it, because by liking and commenting, you tell YouTube's algorithm that you thought it was engaging, and so it ought to show other people the same thing because they'll find it engaging too. And thank you in advance for all your efforts to help me grow my channel.
Jimmy, what's our next episode going to be about?
Next Friday is a Fifth Friday, so we're going to be doing our regular Fifth Friday Weird Question Show, and I'll be looking at subjects like: could dark matter and dark energy be angelic or demonic? Can you pray for the souls in hell? Did baby Jesus have temper tantrums? Is string theory compatible with the faith? If there are infinite possible futures, could there be infinite possible pasts? how do Adam and Eve relate to other early human ancestors, and more.
Folks, be sure to check out the Mysterious World bookstore at mysteriousworldstore.com for links to all the books and videos that Jimmy mentions in the show. You can find links to Jimmy's resources from our discussion on our show notes at mysterious.fm/308. And remember, to help us continue to produce the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. Jimmy Yakin's Mysterious World is also brought to you by Tim Shevlin's Personal Fitness Training for Catholics, providing spiritual and physical wellness programs and daily accountability check-ins. Strengthen yourself to help further God's kingdom. Work out for the right reason with the right mindset. Learn more by visiting fitcatholics.com. And by The Grady Group, a Catholic company bringing financial clarity to their clients across the United States, using safe money options to produce reasonable rates of return for their clients. Learn more at gradygroupinc.com. And by Great Lakes Customs Law, helping importers and individuals with seizures, penalties, and compliance with U.S. customs matters throughout the United States. Visit GreatLakesCustomsLaw.com. Until next time, Jimmy Yakin, thank you for exploring with us our mysterious world.
Thanks, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to Jimmy Yakin's Mysterious World on StarQuest. If you've enjoyed Jimmy Yakin's Mysterious World, you'll also enjoy another StarQuest Network show, The Secrets of Sacred Art. Find it wherever you can find podcasts or at starquest.fm/art.